This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This month marks the 100-year anniversary of one of the saddest chapters, not only in Michigan labor history, in Michigan's history. It's called the Italian Hall Disaster, a terrible tragedy that happened on Christmas Eve 1913 in the Upper Peninsula town of Calumet.
To Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country, I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners are having their big Christmas ball. I will take you in a door and up a high stair. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. I will let you shake hands with the people you see and watch the cookies dance around the big Christmas tree.
Someone yelled fire in a packed hall, and the resulting stampede killed 73 people, 60 of them children. It all happened during the Copper Country Strike, one of the most painful chapters in Michigan's labor history. The Copper Country Strike of 1913 and the Italian Hall disaster are the focus of a new documentary called Red Metal, soon to air on most PBS stations. It's drawn from a book about the disaster called Death's Door, written by my next guest, who's an historian with close ties to the Copper Country, ties that go back to that bitter time. Steve Leto, welcome to Stateside. Good to have you back with us.
Good to be here.
Why do so many historians say that this strike not just changed Michigan, but it changed America?
Well, you know, this was at the beginning of the real unionization efforts in America, and this was at a time when unions weren't protected. So when the copper miners tried to unionize in 1913, they didn't know how it was going to end, and it didn't actually end very well for them in the short term. But there were no laws to protect unions, and it was one of the results of this strike that attention got drawn to the plight of workers, and this strike, I believe, is one of the things that really helped people recognize that legislation needed to be passed, laws needed to be passed to protect workers and to protect union efforts.
And having a tragedy like the Italian Hall tragedy just really focused the nation's attention on the Upper Peninsula.
The strike was called in the summer of 1913 and dragged on for 6 months, and it had actually kind of fallen off the radar by that time. The journalists had all left. It was barely in the news anywhere outside of the area. Then the Italian Hall happens on December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1913. It's front page news in the New York Times, every newspaper across America. When 73 people die and 60 of them are children on Christmas Eve, you suddenly get attention. And
wow.
It brought the news focus right back sharply on the strike.
Let's kind of set the table a little and get us a sense of the history of this. Now, the Copper Rush kind of started in Michigan about the 1840s, and right from the get-go, it was immigrants heading down into the mines. And that was Irish and British and Germans for the most part?
At the beginning, but towards the turn of the century, it became a lot of Finns and Croatians and Italians. And, you know, we talk about the Italian Hall, but most of the people there were not Italian. It was Finnish people and Croatian people. And there was an interesting thing about the Italian Hall disaster in that time. It was racism, but not black and white racism like we think of today. It was language. If you spoke English, you were part of the ruling class. If you didn't speak English, you had the worst job in the mines, and you got the least amount of respect, and you got paid the least money. And that also played into this because the union was the first time that all these disparate groups of people got together for once, where the Finns and the Croatians and the Italians and the Hungarians all worked together for a common goal. And they got together as a union in an attempt to better their working conditions.
And we should note that mining is dangerous, but copper mining, even more dangerous than most.
One of the most brutal jobs you could get in 1913 is to work in a copper mine. On average, one man per week died in the mines. So in any given year, 50, 55 men would die. So, you know, when 73 people die at the Italian Hall, it's a lot of people. But hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men died over time in the mines. But the mines considered that business as usual. And in fact, one mining boss famously said that he didn't make his mines safer because timber cost money, but men cost me nothing. And that's how it was back then.
So here we are, the very beginning of America's labor movement, and the Western Federation of Miners, the WFM, comes to northern Michigan. Tell us about the WFM and how they organized. Were they successful?
Yeah, they were very successful. And the Western Federation of Miners had done a lot of work out west, but they had actually gotten a bit of a reputation because there had been a lot of violence in a couple of their strikes. And some of the reputation they had was deserved. Some of it was not. Mine management in Michigan really played up how violent they'd been out west. But in Michigan, they weren't really that violent. It's just that they did such a good job of organizing. They actually brought in labor organizers who spoke other languages. They make a point of finding a Croatian organizer and a Finnish organizer. And we've got these wonderful handbills they handed out in these different languages. And you can look at them and see they're the same handbill, but just different languages to get all these people together. So they're very good at organizing. But it's true that the Western Federation of Miners didn't want the strike called when it got called. The locals pulled the trigger early, and the Western Union's national headquarters kind of had to play catch-up because they didn't have the war chest to finance the strike properly.
And the miners of Calumet, the miners of the Upper Peninsula, the major issue seems to be it's kind of echoes with what we have today. Oh, we can do the job more cheaply with fewer men. Get that one-man drill in there.
Yeah, the one-man drill was one of the galvanizing forces. Yeah. But it's interesting because, prior to 1913, the mines had they used a lot of labor for a lot of things, including just there were guys who pushed rock all day long called trammers. But the guys who ran the drills, there were these monstrous drills they used to use. It took two guys to operate, and they started bringing in a one-man drill. And, of course, half the drillers are going to lose their jobs. But interestingly enough, when the letter got sent to the mine management with the union demands, it didn't mention the one-man drill.
Oh.
It just said working conditions, hours, wages, and they wanted a way in which they could air their grievances. Because quite often in the mine, if you complained, you got fired. And so they said, we'd kind of like a way that we can complain without getting fired. But the one-man drill became the rallying cry because it was something that people could point to and say, here's one great example of how little they think of us. And it wasn't just that it eliminated jobs. They considered it unsafe because for decades in the mines, men had worked in teams. And you and your buddy would work, go down to the mines together and work together, and he would watch for you, and you'd watch his back.
Sure, sure.
And if you're working a drill by yourself in a pitch-black mine and something malfunctions and you get injured, who's going to help you if your partner's not there? So that was a concern.
I'm talking with Steve Leto, who is a historian whose book is Death's Door, The Truth Behind the Italian Hall Disaster and the Strike of 1913, looking at the Copper Country Strike of 1913 and this disaster in the town of Calumet that happened on Christmas Eve. And before we get into that, Steve, I want to hear about the company, about Calumet and Hecla, because that was really the largest mine company that was involved with this strike.
Yeah, there were several mines in the area, but Calumet and Hecla was like the General Motors in the 1950s. They were the big 900-pound gorilla that they said, here's how we're running this strike, and the other mines all fell in line.
And, oh, by the way, we own all the homes in town that you're living in and the stores.
Yes, and interestingly enough, the president of the Calumet and Hecla is Jim McNaughton, who played football here at U of M, little-known fact. But despite that, it turns out that he wasn't that good of a guy.
Yeah, very hard-nosed, shall we
say.
He
was very hard-nosed, and he was a very, very strict businessman.
So when this strike happens, he is, I'm sure, very displeased. What kind of tactics did he take?
His tactic was, we're not going to negotiate with the union. We're not going to recognize the union. As far as we're concerned, the union is a bunch of socialists who are anti-American, who are out to destroy our way of life.
Which at that time in America's history was a pretty hot button issue, wasn't it?
I liken it to calling someone a communist in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that they, I mean, and we have the correspondence that he wrote to his bosses back in Boston, where he was just, I mean, he was vitriolic about the union and about the union leaders. And I mean, the governor, the president, the Department of Labor, everybody in America said to Jim McNaughton, why won't you just sit down and talk to them? You don't have to agree with them. You don't have to give them anything. Simply talk to them. Woodbridge Ferris famously said, I would sit down and talk to the devil if he wanted to talk to me about something. I wouldn't agree with him, but I'd talk to him. Mm-hmm. Jim McNaughton said, no, if I sit down and talk to them, I'm admitting that they have a right to exist.
So here's this stalemate. The strike starts July 1913, and then we move into winter. You have mm-hmm. people with no income.
Right.
Must have been very, very hard for the strikers.
Yeah, and so as Christmas approached, Big Annie Clements, one of the strike leaders, a woman who is also the head of the Women's Auxiliary of the Western Federation of Miners, decided to hold a party for the children of the striking miners on Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
So they got the hall. There's this big, beautiful two-story Italian hall. And they often did hold pro-union events there. And they were holding this party there. And the intent was, you know, the adults can argue all they want,
yes,
but the kids should have a Christmas. And they announced in the, you know, in the public that, you know, the children can all show up for this. 500 or 600 people showed up for this party.
Boy.
And they were going to get presents and meet Santa Claus and sing songs. And that's what they did until about 4:40 or 4:45 in the afternoon when somebody ran in and yelled fire.
In English.
In English, very, very loudly, and then ran out. And there was no fire.
But we know what happened.
Yes. And unfortunately, a panic occurred, a stampede to get out of the building. And there's a very steep staircase, and in that stairwell, 73 people got trampled to death.
And as you say, 60 of them were children.
And more than half of them were Finnish. So it's a big event in the Finnish community also.
And that's where your family ties
go
back.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Red Metal now. This is Davey Holmbo. His grandmother and his great-aunts were on the second floor of Italian Hall.
My great-grandfather scooped up my grandmother and my two great-aunts, held on to his coattails as they headed towards the stairwell. There was such a rush behind them that the two older sisters were thrown down the hallway and piles of bodies landed on top of them.
So what was the company response and the community response to this tragedy?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This was such a shocking event, not just in the community, but in the country. I mean, it was huge news everywhere. The Mines publicly stated that they were willing to give money to the victims. I think that was a publicity stunt, but they did offer to, you know, to give some money. A lot of people offered to give money.
Mm-hmm.
And the union publicly stated, no, we will bury our own dead, and we're not looking for charity. We want justice. And there were groups going door to door in Calumet trying to give away charity to families that had lost three children or lost a father or lost a mother. And they were being rejected. And I read these great oral histories where people said, you know, I went and knocked on a door and tried to give someone money, and they chased me off their porch, you know. And this is Christmas Day or day after, 2 days after Christmas. It's hard to imagine.
So there was a mass funeral, and Congress actually got involved in an investigation.
Yeah, Congress sent up some congressmen to hold some hearings, but the problem is that they didn't have any power to do anything. They couldn't force anybody to sit down and talk. So they did interview Jim McNaughton. They did interview Charles Moyer, the head of the union. They interviewed all these people, and they took thousands of pages of testimony, which is fascinating reading, but at the end, they said, well, we're not empowered to do anything, so we're just going to go back to Washington now. And eventually, they did start passing laws that were pro-labor, pro-union, but it wasn't right away.
And no one ever determined who the individual was who shouted fire?
Well, the guy got away with it. Let's put it that way.
All right.
I think we know now.
And what's your sense?
And all along, we've believed it was a strike breaker. And they brought in these strike breakers who were out-of-state thugs. The management had. And these guys had been fighting with the unions all summer long. And they could do stuff like this and get away with it. And so I think it was a strike breaker who yelled fire. And he wasn't trying to kill people. He was trying to break the party up. But if you do something reckless and cause the deaths of 73 people, that's a form of homicide.
So the strike ultimately collapsed, didn't it?
Yeah, it collapsed in April of 1914. The union actually just voted to go back to work. They tore up their union cards and they went back to work. And the mine management, as kind of like a little token, gave them an 8-hour workday and gave them a slight raise, but specifically said, it's not because you struck. It's just because we're being nice to you.
And they had to step away and tear up their union cards.
Yes, and that was a big defeat. It would be a decade or two before the unions even tried to set foot in that area again.
Mm. And then, of course, as we know through the 20th century, the copper mining industry just basically kind of wound down. And I think the last mine closed around 1960?
1968.
Okay.
And it was the Calumet and Hecla, and it was shut down by a strike.
Let me ask you this, Steve. In what ways do you think the strike and the Italian Hall disaster, how do they still resonate in copper country or in Michigan?
Well, in the copper country, they're still bitterly divided over it. There are people up there who get angry when I talk about it up there, and there are people up there who get upset. And, you know, we showed the film on Friday at the Calumet Theater, about 100 yards from where the Italian Hall stood, and I saw people in the audience crying, just being reminded of it and seeing the images from it. But I think it's important from a labor history viewpoint. You know, I talked to people today who ask me, why do we need unions? What good are unions? You know, and they think that unions are somehow something that sprang up out of nothing, that they're just there. And they don't understand that unions came from a real need that workers had. You know, before unions came along, there were men dying in the mines, and that was business as usual. And so the unions felt, we got to form these to protect ourselves, and no one else is looking out for us. We've got to do it. So I really think it's important for people to understand that's where unions came from. They came from a place where there was a real need for it.
This is clearly something that just burns in you. What to talk about your personal connection to this story?
Well, my family's from the Upper Peninsula. My family's Finnish. My great grandfather worked in the copper mines, and he worked underground for a few years, and he got out of there as soon as he could. Saved up his money and bought a farm. The farm is still there, being worked by my relatives. And I've always known about this story my entire life, and I'd always just heard it as the Italian Hall disaster, where a bunch of people died. And I never really quite understood the context. And so I started investigating. And the more I investigated, the more I realized that the context is what's important here. If you had an accident where 73 people died randomly, which can happen in these, you know, in this world, you look at it and go, well, you might learn a lesson about, you know, some kind of building safety or something. But here we've got a situation where it happened because of the conflict that arose out of this labor dispute. And so these victims did really die in the name of labor.
My guest was Steve Leto, and his book, Death's Door, is a source material for a documentary called Red Metal. It'll be airing December 17th on most PBS stations, and it is very, very, very powerful. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing the story and reminding everyone about a very crucial part of Michigan's history.
Thank you. It's always great to be here.
Yeah, take a trip with me in 1913. Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners are having their big Christmas ball. I will take you in a door and up a high stair. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. I will let you shake hands with the people you see. And watch the kids dance around the big Christmas tree.